Okay, it looks like the person putting together this program was trying to play in terms of some kind of geography game. So we go from West Coast, East Coast, Southeast, and then we are moving to the Midwest. In my talk, we will not be, it's not the focus of my talk is not wetlands, but that will be some kind of a cousin. We'll be discussing flood regime in riparian areas in Indiana. Before I move further, I would like to acknowledge my funding sources, USGS and USDA, and small army of graduate students and undergraduate who helped me during the last couple of years with this research. So I would like to preface my presentation by recognizing wetlands, riparian areas in terms of the susceptibility to flooding. And when we have a flooding event, that will bring all type of organic matter or mineral organic debris, and that will come and be deposited on the wet, on the riparian zone, and that could lead, the fresh organic materials can lead to an enhancement of CO2 production. In addition, by the wet soil conditions created during flood events will impede oxygen transfer into the soil, and that could ultimately lead to formation of methane and nitrous oxide. So here we probably preaching to the choir, giving the people in this audience, knowing that CO2 and methane and nitrous oxide, those are greenhouse gases, and we are concerned about those because of the impact on the energy balance of the Earth. And in addition to that, nitrous oxide and methane are known to have been implicated into the in the stratospheric ozone depletion. A lot of studies have shown that upland forests are important sinks for methane, and that is well demonstrated. But what we don't know is riparian forests, how those ecosystems a sink or a source for methane. Do they behave more like upland forests will do regarding to methane? So from what I've just said, the objective of the study, part of this presentation, we look at how we monitor greenhouse gases in riparian forests in central Indiana, and we try to link the flooding frequency with our soil biology and the dynamics of those gases in riparian forests. The work I'm presenting was conducted at two sites, but really there will be three sites. This one, there will be two different stands here. One is Southwest Way Park. This is a municipal park that was established in 1946, but the forest I've been describing was already established by the time the park was already in place by the time the park was established. So we estimate that is more than 80 years old. And here in the other side is McCormick State Park. This is the oldest state park in the state of Indiana, established in 1916. And again, I will show you some more description of this site in a minute. So there is a distance of about 60 kilometers between those two sites. And then there is a USGS gauge that is just south of the Southwest Way Park. I will show data from that, but understanding when we see the peak of discharge right here at the at this site, it will take a couple of days for this discharge to affect greenhouse gas dynamics down here. This is the Southwest Way Park. Again, that's a shot of that during the spring. This area is flooded once or twice a year, and then we term that as occasionally flooded. So that would be OF. And this is a silt loam. The other two stands at McCormick State Park. So this one is a upland forest. It is in the second terrace. It's rarely flooded. Based on information I get from people on site, it can be flooded about once or every 15, 20 years. And it's also a silt loam. And downslope from that, about 12 feet downslope in terms of gradient. So this is another stain located on the floodplain, is at the confluence between the White River and the McCormick stream, which is a second order stream. So now, it's really important to remember when the White River is high, water cannot flow from the McCormick stream. So therefore, we have slack water forming here, and then that will affect greenhouse gas dynamics. Some of the soil properties, first of all, we look at organic carbon. This is the stock of organic carbon in those different sites. Again, the color code, we are going the next few slides, will be the same. The light green for the rarely flooded, and the occasionally flooded, and the most frequently flooded. So here we see we got more organic carbon in the occasionally flooded, and the CN ratio of the organic carbon also is higher in the occasionally flooded sites. Still, those pool of carbon are quite huge when you look at other forests in the same area, upland forests in this area. So there is a site for huge carbon accumulation in those riparian forests. I did some microplate assessment of the microbial community composition and get some soils and incubate those ecoplates with 10 to the minus 4 dilution and look at the absorbance of those wells as the different carbon sources get metabolized by the microbes. And then you can see the red, two greens, the frequently flooded and the rarely flooded sites, they tend to behave the same in terms of their capacity to metabolize different carbon sources. And the occasionally flooded site was distinct. And when you put all these things together and developing the Shannon index of microbial diversity, we can see the less diverse microbial population was on the occasionally flooded site. The most frequently flooded, the less frequently flooded, the rarely flooded, and the more frequently flooded were kind of similar. So I don't have a mechanic definitive explanation for that. That's something I'm working on. But it was really curious to find in the literature a study published in 1999 conducted somewhere in Canada, and they saw some kind of a similar pattern where the soil from the riparian area and they are a place that was way further away from the riparian zone at the highest microbial diversity, and the intermediary zone was at the lowest. So regardless of the mechanism, so this diversity needs to be expressed in terms of soil functions. So the functions we look at in our study, we look at greenhouse gases emission. So I'm going to show data in carbon dioxide emission, nitrous oxide, and methane the next two or three slides. This is for carbon dioxide flux from the three sites. Again, this is the rarely flooded, the occasionally flooded, and the frequently flooded. And the dark line on the back, this is the discharge from the USGS gauge. And one of the things you can see is the flooded sites, they tend to be more activity in terms of CO2 production. So again, that's why be an indication you get material being transported during flooding events. You get fresh material in those ecosystems as opposed to the one that's not flooded. But also you can see the flood of, there was a flood we were able to sample in April 2007. And you can see there is quite a response of the two sites to flooding. But the impact of flooding was really most noted when we look at nitrous oxide and methane. Here, this is the non-flooded site. There isn't much of a change. But the one that was frequently flooded, and you can see the flood came here about late March, and then there was a quick response in terms of nitrous oxide production on the site that is way north, close to the gauge. So there is a good match between the fluctuation in the river discharge and the emission of nitrous oxide at that site. But the other side that is further downstream, so it takes a couple of days for the flow to get there and also for the slack water to develop. And then we were able to find there was some kind of a delay in terms of nitrous oxide emission at that site. We look at the methane flux. It was really a surprise to look at all those riparian sites. They were mostly sink for methane. Everything, the flux was below zero, always negative. Except after this big flooding event in April 2007, when we have the slack water developed in the frequently flooded site, and then we start a huge peak of methane emission. So this peak alone changed this frequently flooded site from a sink to a net source of methane. So this is just a summary. Look at the carbon dioxide flux. This is the pattern, and we'll compare that to the carbon SOC stock in the those riparian forests. We can see really a match between the sites with the highest carbon stocks also has a highest average CO2 emission. So that would not be too much of a surprise. And also, as hypothesized, we see a trend between emission of nitrous oxide and flooding frequency. The site with the lowest flooding frequency has the lowest nitrous oxide emission, and the highest one has the highest nitrous oxide emission. So the same thing for methane. So if the one frequently flooded site was a net source. If we were to discount the flux from after the April 2007 flood, so this site could have been a sink as well, but now it's a source of methane. So in summary, we find a nonlinear pattern between microbial diversity and flooding frequency, with the less frequently flooded and the most frequently flooded sites have the highest diversity. We found a direct relationship between CO2 emission and soil temperature. I removed that slide because I thought we would not have time to look at it, but I think everybody will understand that. And also we see a direct relationship between emission and organic carbon stocks. The nitrous oxide and methane emission increase with flooding frequency, and surprisingly, most of those riparian forests, except after big, large flooding events, behave more like upland soils, acting more like a strong sink for methane. And when I compare those methane sinks to some upland soils, they can be 1 or 1.5 times higher than typically recorded for in the Midwest for upland forests. Was that this one you?
Yeah, so that occasionally flooded had the highest.
Yeah. So I think also there is a question of history of those, because this one, the occasionally flooded site, we have air photo dating from the 1940s. I think 1940s or 1960s. So the forest was already established with a good stand. We don't have those type of photos for the other two sites. We have only historical records saying in 1916 the site was no longer in agriculture, so they let the forest establish. But we don't know how those, really in terms of age, we say greater than 80 years old, but there could be some age difference between those different stands. And at this point, we cannot confirm this as well. No.
They're at that antecedent moisture content or whatever you sample that?
Yeah.
Okay. And your rarely flooded site was only flooded once every 15 years, is that right?
Yeah, or 15, 20, yeah.
So during your sampling, the rarely flooded wasn't flooded?
No,
right?
No. No, it was not flooded. That was in November. No, it was not
flooded. So it was only the frequently flooded that was flooded.
Not really flooded at that time, because when they say it's flooded, the flood, it can be underwater for maybe a couple of days, and then the water will recede, and then that's when we can go and do our measurement. But over a 1 year period, there could be water standing on the in that stand for 4, 5, 6 times in a year. So that's what we classify that as frequently flooded area.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.